Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Sir David King, who is the Chief Scientific Advisor to the British Prime Minister and head of the Office of Science and Technology there. He continues to be the 1920 Professor of Chemistry at Cambridge University, where he was Chairman of the Chemistry Department and Master of Downing College. Sir David, welcome to Berkeley.
Delighted to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Durban in South Africa. I was brought up in Johannesburg, went to school in Johannesburg, went to university there, and completed my PhD there.
Uh-huh. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, interestingly, parents and the environment. I mean, first of all, my father was in the paint business in South Africa, and he was also very much a Victorian sort of figure. Mm-hmm. Each of his kids were actually sent into the paint business. So when, from the age of 13, my vacations were spent in different parts of the business. And his expectation was that we would move in and take over. I enjoyed immensely being in the paint laboratory, and that was one reason why I ended up choosing science as a career.
Mm-hmm. And chemistry, was it a natural step from painting, moving beyond painting?
No, I think that chemistry, paint chemist was the title my father had in line for me. Mm-hmm. But what I think was, I could easily have gone into physics, chemistry, or biology. Mm-hmm. It was a science that I was really fascinated by. If I look back to my childhood, I know that I had an unusually inquiring mind. I had to know how things worked. Mm-hmm. And irritated a lot of people with all of those queries about how things worked.
Mm-hmm. And were there any teachers that you had in South Africa or later that really
shaped
your thinking?
I would have to say it was more reading that influenced mm-hmm. me and just following natural curiosity. Mm-hmm. I can't look back, as many people do, and say there was the teacher that mm-hmm. really sparked my interest. At the same time, of course, I'm talking about a climate in South Africa which became very difficult. I left in 1963, in the year of getting my PhD, which was the year Mandela was arrested. It's the year when South Africa really began to take on all the attributes of a police state. So outside the university, we had armed police visibly present in big vans and army equipment every day. Mm-hmm. So the other aspect of my childhood that I would have to say affected me enormously from that period was the attitude I took towards apartheid, as it was then, and the political system. And as a matter of fact, I was asked to leave by the government mm-hmm. of the country I was born in.
For political activities, or?
Well, my political activities amounted, as a PhD student, to writing letters to the national press. Mm-hmm. And actually, this was quite heady for a young man. The national press printed my letters, and as a matter of fact, one of the editors called me up one day and asked me to write a letter on a particular topic. Mm-hmm. And I was very flattered. What I didn't figure, and this was my own naivety, was that writing letters to the national press was a political activity. I thought, you know, we had the freedom of the press, all of the machinery of a democracy was in place. I hadn't quite anticipated that I was inviting myself into a major interview and an exit.
How did your training in science impact your thinking about politics, or did it?
Well, there's an interesting point. I think the evidence-led, logical approach I have to things meant that I felt affronted by the system out there. It was very apparent to me, for example, that the man who was in the kitchens of our family home and prepared our meals was an extremely intelligent person. Mm-hmm. And yet his position in society could never reflect the level of his intelligence. There were amazingly extreme things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Separate entrances for black people and white people into a post office where they were both served by the same person once they got into the post office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just official rules that were mind-boggling, actually.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was your work in chemistry?
Well, my work in chemistry has always been in solid surfaces and the interaction between solid surfaces and gases. I started out in my PhD on catalysis, ammonia synthesis, the old one. How do you make ammonia from nitrogen and hydrogen more effectively? And I've always moved, or did for the first 10 or 15 years, towards a more theoretical, more complete analysis of what a surface is and dealing with it on the atomic and electronic level.
Mm-hmm.
And so today we have a laboratory which combines state-of-the-art theory, quantum theory, with state-of-the-art instrumental development. I think the objective, let me say, is to get back to more complex phenomena, but with this sound base that we can now bring to it.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the wonderful thing that's now happening in science with all the computer power that we have.
Mm-hmm.
We can tackle enormously complex systems, but with the kind of certainty that previously we could only bring to simple systems.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we look at catalysis in industry or semiconductors, or the Earth system, we can look at very complex phenomena with enormous quantitative understanding now. And I think that's the most exciting thing that's happened in my period in science.
I always like to ask scientists who are our guests, what is the temperament, the character required to be a good scientist?
Well, I think the first thing is a continuing sense of excitement in discovery. Whenever I and my research group have a success, I still feel an enormous sense of celebration. You're tackling a problem, and sometimes it takes years and years, and finally you get there. And however small in retrospect this breakthrough might be, at that moment the sense of excitement is still tremendous. I think that's critically important. And then once you've got that, all of the hard work, the slog, the understanding, the bench work in the lab, all of that becomes worthwhile. I have to keep telling PhD students this because they may have slogged for 2 or 3 years without seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. But the longer you work like that before the light suddenly appears, the better that eureka moment is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maintaining that sense of excitement in the science is critically important, and for some of us it's actually quite easy.
Mm-hmm. And what about the science itself? What are its characteristics? I mean, I know that science requires a cosmopolitanism, an internationalism. It requires a rigor. It requires a search for the evidence that proves the truth. Talk a little about that and how it's affected you.
Well, my view is that the scientific process is a process that has emerged over the last 400 or 500 years, and the biggest step forward was probably the Royal Society setting up its meetings in the form where a scientist giving a presentation had to be able to show evidence to the audience. And so actually doing experiments in front of the audience was de rigueur in those times, to show the audience that it worked and you could repeat the experiment. So producing your evidence and being challenged. The idea of challenge is absolutely central to science. You don't make propositions. You are trying to make a description of the real world. And the challenge, the best challenges, will come from people who've made better observations of the same piece of the real world that you're trying to study. And of course, there's a strong element of the ego coming through in this. If you challenge the top scientist and push him off his or her pedestal, you're hoping to occupy that pedestal. only for the next person to come along and try and knock you off it. I think there is a lot of the ego in the process. But I think the important thing is the sense of challenge and the progress that comes from continued improvement in the study of the real world. The better the instrument you have for observing the real world, the better off you're going to be in your description of it. And so while we're all going through the process of standing on the shoulders of scientists who've gone before, we're also able to criticize them because of our better viewpoint with better instrumentation.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your present role, you have entered in a way into government service. I mean, you're not a in politics per se, but you are at the interface of government and science. Talk a little about these two very different worlds, because they are different, but you've already suggested some of the ways in which they might gain from each other.
You're quite right. So my position as chief scientific advisor is as independent scientist. The post was invented by Churchill during the Second World War. He wanted a scientist who could give him objective, hard facts and challenge him. And the post still exists in that form. The post has, of course, developed. So I have a big office, a large budget, which the first holder of the post, F.H. Lindemann, who was head of physics in Oxford, didn't have. But nevertheless, the basic tenet of the post is still the same. Now, I had no idea before moving into this post exactly how to cope with the problem that you've raised. Mm. But dealing with science and presenting it to politicians, what is critically important is being able to do it in simple words. You can deal with sophisticated phenomena, but deal with it in simple phraseology.
And so what is that problem? Because that's very critical, because it also relates to the public debate on issues. Is it finding the simple language? Is it presenting that simple language to the media and the public generally, and then obviously to the leaders of government? So that are you running tutorials both for large and small audiences in a way?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So on the one hand, talking directly to the Prime Minister one-on-one, mm-hmm. and by the way, the Prime Minister has the sort of, he's a barrister, he has the mind where he wants to take ownership of what you're telling him. Mm-hmm. So I might talk to him for 40 minutes, at the end of it he stops me and then he goes back mm-hmm. over what I've told him to see that he's taken ownership of it. Mm-hmm. Now, in the bigger world, I will go on the national media in the UK when we're faced with major situations and attempt to explain it. As a matter of fact, when there's a tsunami in Indonesia, I will be going on the media to explain the origins and how we in Britain might better manage the risk in future to our populations and to other populations through better understanding of the science. And that is my basic message, mm-hmm. that using an evidence-based approach, scientists now can tackle enormously complex things. My job is to bring that understanding to politicians so that they can make better judgments.
And does the arrow go the other way also, in the sense that there's a societal problem that the government is worried about, and that you have to essentially go to the scientific community and suggest, cajole, seek to persuade people to make these problems the focus of their curiosity?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, for example, post 9/11 would be exactly that situation, where we have set up a research capacity that didn't really exist before, looking into the potential threats to our society from 9/11 type activities. So I will be proactive in going out to the research community exactly along the lines that you say. And I think in terms of giving advice to government, I wonder if I could just explain to you how I first got involved in that in a very real sense.
Please, please.
The foot and mouth disease epidemic that broke out in the UK in 2001 came just a few months into my appointment. And I sat like everybody else watching this epidemic develop, and about 2 weeks in, I gathered data from the Ministry of Agriculture that was handling the epidemic and called in a group of epidemiological modelers, and together we modeled the epidemic. Four different groups of scientists ended up modeling the epidemic. Based on the models, I could see that with the control procedures we had in place then, the epidemic was actually out of control. So I had to go to the Prime Minister and express that view, and then also say what should be done to get it under control. So we ran these programs in real time, so we're talking about working around the clock 24 hours a day. In real time, we managed to model the epidemic and then show with various control procedures how best to bring it under control. So I went to the Prime Minister and explained it to him. I had to explain, for example, that we had an exponential growth which in the epidemic, which meant, I said, today, Prime Minister, we have 45 new infected farms in the country, and in 9 days' time, because it was a nine-day doubling period, we'll have 90. And I could say that with some certainty. But, I said, if you follow this procedure, we can turn this into exponential decay within 2 days. Now, of course, the Prime Minister was quite taken with that idea. And so he called together a meeting of the appropriate government members, and effectively we changed the policy, and the epidemic followed our prediction. That was science being used in real time for government to see how well it could operate.
In this and other cases, what is the problem that you observe, if not a party to, of where private interests want to oppose what science is telling you and what you are telling the Prime Minister? Is that a process that you can contribute to, or is that the Prime Minister and his government's problem, really?
My own view is that I have to work with the Prime Minister on the science advice or other cabinet members. Because if I give advice that's inappropriate because the private sector, for whatever reason, won't cooperate with that, I have to go away and come back with advice which takes that into account. On the other hand, for example, coming back to the foot and mouth disease epidemic, our model showed that if we could take out all of the animals on a farm where the epidemic was already being shown quickly, and then follow that up with taking out all the animals on all the neighboring farms where there was a common fence, we could bring the epidemic under control quickly. Now, the private owner of those farms was saying, but my animals are perfectly healthy. And my model was saying, they may be healthy today, but if they go down tomorrow, your animals will become a virus factory and the epidemic just continues. So the model was saying do that, but many of the farmers were objecting. That's the point where I found myself going on television to explain to the public the basis of the model, that at the end of the day, the number of animals we'd have to cull would be considerably reduced by switching off the epidemic rapidly at the expense of taking out the animals on these farms.
The model you're describing, do you think it potentially can work well in all democracies?
I think that, to be honest, it's the kind of model that all democracies need to have. And if I could make a statement there, I think that today the scientific community is considerably more capable than it has been in the past to assist governments to avoid, to reduce risk to their own population. I would therefore say prime ministers and presidents would ignore the advice from the science community at the peril of their own populations. Again, let me give you an example from the tsunami in Indonesia. The scientific community, the geological community, now understands plate tectonics, the movement of these great plates around the Earth, with quite considerable detail. And the scientific community, based here in California and in Britain, together the seismologists had predicted that the next big disaster was going to be on that region within along Indonesia, mm-hmm. Where these plates were meeting, and yet no governments took action. No governments in the region were prepared to pay the $30 million that was estimated to set up an early warning system. The disaster has cost in excess of 200,000 lives. My view is that with an early warning system, that could have been reduced to less than 100,000. Mm-hmm. Now, there's an example where the science was available, and I'm working internationally to see if we can improve the system whereby the current state of knowledge of the scientists is brought to the attention of the political communities.
Now, climatic change and global warming has been one of the big focuses of your tenure, and I want to spend some time talking about it because I think we'll be able to draw on a number of the things that that we've talked about. And just in line with what you just said, this is a problem where it's not a catastrophe tomorrow, right, but down the road. And so what we then have to bring is a kind of a future orientation in order to make a compelling case. Now, so I want to talk a little about this, and I want to walk you through this, and I want to recommend to the audience at the website, which we will link to when we do the transcript of your office, is your Zuckerman lecture, which I found to be the clearest statement of the problem that a general audience can understand. So in a way, we're drawing on that now. So let me ask you first, what does science tell us about global warming now? And this is a science that, as you well point out, comes from a long history of science. There's a history here where the scientists have been working in the way that you just described to grapple with this problem. Talk a little about that.
I think that's the first point I want to make, mm-hmm. that the science of climate change is a mature subject. It goes back to the great French mathematician Fourier. And Fourier is the one who sits there thinking, what determines the surface temperature of the Earth that we live on? Why is the average temperature about 18 degrees centigrade? And he considers, well, it must be because energy comes in from the sun, but then the Earth would keep heating up if that was all, but it's going out through heat radiation as the Earth gets warm. And we get a net balance, and so the temperature sits at an average of 18 degrees centigrade. But then he asked himself a very simple question. What happens at night? At night, effectively, I switch off the solar energy coming into that portion of the Earth, but it's still radiating energy out. So the temperature should drop precipitately, as it does on the Moon, and therefore we should see a temperature drop of around 30 degrees centigrade at night. And he concluded there's something else operating here. The atmosphere is absorbing energy and maintaining the warmth in the Earth. Now, I'm elaborating on this precisely because once you've understood that, it's like putting a blanket or a duvet cover on your bed at night. And if somebody comes along and adds another duvet cover on, you're going to get a lot warmer. Mm-hmm. And if we now add to the greenhouse gases, and we know which gases those are, the minority gases, carbon dioxide and water vapor, if we now add to those greenhouse gases, and that's what we're doing by burning fossil fuels, we've got to anticipate a rise in global temperatures. It's really as simple as that. There are a lot of other factors, and the modern computer programs that are running predictions on what the climate will look like in 100 years' time are probably the most complex computer programs in the world, taking many different factors into account. But nevertheless, it does boil down to adding to the greenhouse gases and therefore adding to the blanketing effect.
With what consequences? What does it matter, right, to be the devil's advocate here?
Yeah, right. Wouldn't it be pleasant in England if we could just grow our own grapes and make beautiful wines as they do today in France? We can grow all our own wheat. You know, we will simply see our farming being transformed to a warmer climate farming. And for the UK, that is the big plus, and our beaches would be very heavily populated with sunbathers. The problems are that the impacts of climate change are going to be very severe for most nations. The most obvious is rising sea levels. Between an ice age and a warm period, the sea level difference, we know, over the last million years, each time has been about 120 meters. And what happens during an ice age is that water from the oceans percolates onto land masses as ice. And then as you go out of an ice age, it melts back into the oceans. So the ocean level goes up and down around 100 meters through a warm period and an ice age. Now we're entering what might be described as the first hot period, because the carbon dioxide level has been oscillating in an ice age from 200 parts per million and a warm period 260, 270 parts per million, in line with the greenhouse effect. But we've now, by burning fossil fuels, increased the level to 379 parts per million, and we must anticipate, with rising temperatures, further loss of ice on Earth. If the Greenland ice sheet alone should all melt, sea levels will rise by 6 to 7 meters. Now, that's not going to happen overnight, mm-hmm. and certainly not the day after tomorrow. It's going to take quite a while. But nevertheless, we could reach a point where we begin irreversibly to lose all of the ice on Greenland. We're already seeing a very significant loss of the Arctic. And for the first time a few years ago, a ship was actually able to go over the North Pole because of the loss of Arctic ice. Now, that ice is not land-based, so it doesn't cause a significant change in the sea level of the oceans. But any land-based ice will raise sea levels. Sea levels are also rising because hot water occupies a bigger volume, so there's two reasons for sea levels to rise. That's just one set of impacts. If I can just comment on another
one. Sure, please.
We're very heavily dependent in our living conditions on the particular weather conditions that each of our countries is used to. And if we have a rapid change, and by rapid I mean 50 to 100 years in weather conditions, I think it's going to be very difficult for us to adapt to these rapid changing conditions. The one example I would take is the Indian monsoon. In India, if the monsoon is 10% less intense one year, then the agricultural food crop can be so severely low that they face starvation. If the monsoon is 10% higher one year, they have massive floods and fatalities arising from that. So the Indian population has set up a system of living that is very sensitive to a particular narrow band of monsoon activity. But if we change the climate, we've got to anticipate massive changes in monsoon behavior. Now, that is just one example. Examples exist all around the Earth. We move up into the north from here, into Canada and Alaska. We all know the permafrost is melting, and yet the oil pipelines are built onto the permafrost, and in places are dangerously sinking. Many people's houses are sinking into the melting permafrost. So although you may say, well, I'd rather not have the permafrost, it'd be much nicer to have wheat fields here, nevertheless, the existing cities and lifestyle are built around the permafrost.
So what is the the problem in some countries, the United States would be an example, in getting these points across? Why is there such resistance to the evidence, do you think?
Well, I mean, that is a very good question. It goes slightly outside the science, I think. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I think it's important to tackle it. I have to try and understand that. If I look at the question, I think there are some uncomfortable conclusions that some politicians see in the kind of action that is required to be taken. It may be that you consider dealing with climate change, switching from fossil fuel dependence to renewable energies and developing other new renewable energies through new technology. It may be that you feel that's an expensive process and we can't afford to do it. Or it may be that changing from our existing dependence on fossil fuels to a new system is going to affect our GDP growth. Now, I happen to think that that's poor economics, and I can demonstrate that. In the UK, we have grown our economy since 1990, which is not randomly chosen, it's the beginning of the Kyoto period. We have grown our economy by about 38%. And over that period of time, our basket of greenhouse gases has been diminished by 12%. Hmm. So we've shown we can grow our economy and reduce emissions. But that message turns out to be a very difficult one to get across, particularly, and I understand this point, in economies such as yours here in the United States, where the energy generating industries are heavily dependent on coal. And quite clearly what we're arguing for is leaving the coal in the ground if we haven't got a safe method of capturing the carbon dioxide and storing it as we burn it up. The whole point about the greenhouse gas model and what is required is to avoid using fossil fuels. That was nature's way of sequestering carbon. And by finding it and burning it, we're reversing on that process. I think that's part of the reason for the opposition. Environmental lobbies in the past have, I think, tended to be associated with greens and lefts. Mm-hmm. Now, for me, the message to get across is, in Britain, 90% of our public now think global warming is one of the most severe problems we face. There is tripartisan agreement in our political system. The Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, and the Labour government all agree that action is required. It's not a left-right political issue. It's simply hard common sense. But I think that that question of green left-wing is still a residual question that needs to be handled.
Is it also, well, I would be interested, how did this consensus come about in Britain that you've just described? Is it that the scientific case was made and the leading political leaders in all parties embraced the message?
I think that was critically important. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the scientific community have, I think, quite a good standing in Britain, but not always the case, because in the BSE crisis, the trust in the scientific community was lost very significantly. But nevertheless, the fact is that the Prime Minister has given a very strong lead on this, and I have been questioned by the leaders of the opposition in private on the issue, and they have quite clearly accepted the argument. Now, I think what the public sees is a consensus. It's not to say that the public feels this is an easy issue to deal with. It's a major challenge. But nevertheless, we've managed a consensus. Now, in the United States, it's interesting to see that today, compared with our 90% recognizing this as a problem, you have roughly 60%. It's more than half of the population in the United States. I think that is swinging very rapidly in the direction of people understanding that this is really a hard issue that needs to be tackled. And with these various natural disasters that are happening, and the fact that science can help diminish risks to populations, I think that the public is beginning to understand that we're not just here to make fearsome statements about the future. It's very hard-headed.
Mm-hmm. And in your Zuckerman article, you make some comparisons of, you say the average Briton emits about 9 tons per year of carbon dioxide. In the U.S., it's 21. In India, it's 1 ton. So these countries are very differently placed in the way in which they contribute to the problem. But in some ways, the politics and the interests thus far have not, you know, swung, although they seem to be moving in that direction. So then what can government then do to cajole, move industry, move a whole society, you know, in the right direction? We have the consensus, but then I presume that your office and the scientific community have to help government define the policies that make sense.
So what the British government decided was that we ought to take a leadership role on this issue. And in order to establish a leadership position, we announced in 2003 that we were going beyond Kyoto, that we in Britain would reduce our emissions by 60% by 2050, and we were not making it conditional on other countries joining us. We're simply saying this is such an important problem that we're going to announce that we'll do it, and we'll tell people how we're going to do it. We have set out our policies to achieve that. Now, in order to really achieve that change, what is absolutely clear is that we need fiscal drivers. We need an economic process. And the key process has got to be the phrase to internalize the external costs of producing the carbon dioxide, which means that we need to attach a value to not emitting carbon dioxide. And we come therefore very easily into carbon dioxide emissions trading. And we in Britain began emissions trading within the UK, just as California is moving towards that now. And we've now moved from January this year into emissions trading across Europe. Interestingly, when we started emissions trading, the bargaining on the beginning cost reached a level of €8 per ton, about $8 per ton of carbon dioxide emitted, which in my view was too low to bring about the right behavior. But the market is now determining the price, and the price is running between 20 and 30 euros per ton now. So the market has very rapidly pushed it up to a level that I consider is close to the desired level to produce the right behavior. In other words, at 30 euros per ton, a utility driving a power station with coal will now find that it's doubling the cost of the fuel when you add in the cost of carbon dioxide emission. So now you need to think very carefully about what alternative fuels you ought to use in order to optimize your own profit margin.
And has the European community partnership contributed substantially to creating a larger zone in which these scientific insights are being implemented into policy?
Yes, so the European Union has now embraced this this notion. We in Britain are going way beyond Kyoto with our 60% reduction commitment. The Germans have made a commitment to 50% reduction by 2050. But across the European Union, there is now a consensus that we need action on this. But having said that, what we all recognize is that Europe can't tackle this problem on its own. The biggest single emitter of carbon dioxide in the world is, of course, the United States, emitting with, 4% of the population, 25% of the world's carbon dioxide is produced here in the United States. And clearly, we all believe that action is required from the United States to synchronize with what we're doing in Europe. Now, with the ratification of Kyoto, we're anticipating that the emissions trading that we've begun in Europe will extend to Japan, Canada, and Russia. So it's going fully international. There's a new commodity on the market. That commodity is carbon dioxide. It's trading very briskly. London is the financial center for that trade at the moment. We'd be delighted if New York and Chicago would like to come in with us. And I would make a very simple prediction that in 5 or 10 years' time, the new gold standard on the value of different currencies is going to be carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. Once we reach international trading in carbon dioxide, this would be the very natural replacement.
You must be an observer of the effectiveness of these policies, you know, across different countries. I'm curious, what perturbations do you think will be necessary for a place like the United States? Will a catastrophe like Katrina, which may or may not be the direct result of global warming, be a wake-up call, which will then move the political class? Or will it be the market, really, that makes this decision, the market together with the emerging international consensus, which you're describing?
And those are two major driving forces, but I would just throw in as well, one of the British driving forces has been the Association of British Insurers, the insurance companies. And looking at the risks to populations and to the built environment from these disasters and the impact of climate change on them, the insurers know better than most exactly what the cost is to them. So I think we do have the market, and interesting to see the reaction of the New York and Chicago Stock Exchange to this new commodity trading. I think we have popular opinion, and I can't say, I believe that's critical. And finally, you do have the wish of governments to be seen to be leading. I mean, in our case, I think the Prime Minister was very happy to take a leading role on this issue. We in the rest of the world, frankly, tend to look to the United States to take a leading role on issues of this kind. You're a leading science and technology driven nation, and it would be good to go back to a position where the United States was in the lead. I'm very pleased that Governor Schwarzenegger has announced that California will reduce emissions by 80% by 2050. This is the only time I'm going to say I'm happy to see that Britain is in second place.
What about the newcomers to the international economy? China, yes. India, Brazil, because community emerging consensus is going to have to make a deal with them. What will the bargain look like? Because clearly the argument on the other side can be, well, we haven't had a chance to develop yet. Why should we tie our hands just as we're about to take off and our economies are going to take off and provide economic benefits to huge populations that have been in poverty?
The two biggest nations, China and India, with a population over a billion, are also the most rapidly developing economies. India at 7 or 8% per annum, China even close to 10% per annum growth rate. And that growth is fueling the demand for fossil fuels and energy. Now, we clearly have to take this on board, which is precisely why the British Prime Minister invited the heads of those two states, together with the other rapidly developing economies, Brazil, Mexico, and South Africa, to the meeting he held, he was presiding over in Gleneagles, the G8. And it was to embrace them in the discussion about climate change that he invited them to the Gleneagles meeting for. If we look ahead, our position is that the developed world has to show leadership. We have to show that we can handle the problem. And then when we turn to the developing world, recognizing their need to develop their economies, we need to, in the light of that, persuade them also that it's going to be in their interest to deal with the climate change problem. But in doing so, I think we again have to show leadership by engaging in technology transfer. So as we develop these alternatives to fossil fuel or carbon capture and storage, we need a very simple process of technology transfer into those rapidly developing countries so they can leapfrog. They don't have to go through the process of development as we have ourselves.
I hear you saying that what will lead us to a future in which some of these problems are solved is that the evidence of science through politics has an impact on values, yes, generally, both nationally and internationally, to change our definition of success, prosperity, and achievement, to use very... Is that a fair assessment?
I think it is. And at the moment, I think we've developed our economies in such a way that we've all come to treat energy as barely costing us anything. I think culturally the most important change that we need to make is to treat energy as a precious commodity. And energy efficiency gains are actually relatively easy to make. I mean, in Britain, the way we plan to handle our 60% reduction is quite a large dependence on improvements in the efficiency with which we use energy. It's an attitude of mind, but of course the attitude of mind is considerably helped by proper economic processes. So we are, we're not just relying on people switching off the lights as they leave a room, mm-hmm, but it's not bad if people do that as a continual cultural reminder.
Mm-hmm. Now the key to all of the things that we've been talking about, science's contribution to government, changing the world so we can ensure the future of coming generations, really is built on the public's trust in science. I know on your Office of Technology website you have posted a brilliant speech by your Prime Minister on science and society. And he says, we need, therefore, a robust, engaging dialogue with the public. We need to reestablish trust and confidence in the way that science can demonstrate new opportunities and offer new solutions. But he also raises this issue of the trust in science, that science provides evidence, and sometimes the values that we hold, the prejudices, want to dismiss what science has to say out of hand. Talk a little about that, because that is, if not a problem in your country, it's definitely a problem in our country.
No, it is a problem in our country, and it's interesting how the problem manifests itself in totally different ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the two examples of this are, on the one hand, genetically modified foodstuffs, and on the other hand, attitudes to therapeutic cloning. So with genetically modified foodstuffs, in the UK and in Europe generally, there was an enormous concern about whether or not genetically modified foodstuffs would actually turn out to be unhealthy for us to consume, whether or not they would be poor for our environment if we allowed farmers to grow them. Now, I think that concern was heightened by the BSE crisis. Because I mean, for the first time, here we had people eating what they considered to be perfectly healthy meat, and yet suddenly faced with a risk associated with variant CJD. The actual outcome is a death, a fatality of something like, proportion of something like 130 people in the UK have died from variant CJD to date. But when this broke out, the expectation was that most of us who had eaten hamburgers from British beef over that period were running the risk of getting it. So it was a massive issue in the United Kingdom. And now here were scientists coming along, genetically modifying foodstuffs. And they were saying, well, remember what happened to BSE? So I think that was the linkage that was made that didn't exist here. But it did lead to a serious mistrust in the scientific community. So when the scientific community came forward with all the evidence backing the GM foods that had been allowed through our rather detailed regulatory process, the public were not prepared to accept it. And so today, you will not walk into a supermarket and find any GM foodstuffs on the shelves. Mm. The public have determined, not the government, that this is the case. In the case of therapeutic cloning, There, I think, a very important thing emerges as a difference. With GM foods, people were saying, what's the advantage to me? Why should I have GM corn when I can take non-GM corn instead? I don't have to take any risk at all. In the case of therapeutic cloning, the public saw, here's a potential advantage to me. If I do get Alzheimer's in my old age, it's quite possible that in the future, through the therapies developing through this process, that I may be able to get treated. Or if I'm in an accident and have a spinal injury, perhaps they will be able to develop mechanisms for rebuilding my spine. Those were the issues at discussion. And we had in the House of Commons and the House of Lords what I think were the most intelligent debates on this issue, the cloning issue, that we've had for years. It was an open debate, no whips used, and the decision went very soundly, much to many people's surprise, in favor of allowing therapeutic cloning under a closely regulated process. So I think in the end, people are looking at scientific advance to give them advantage, and then they're relatively happy with it. If they don't see the personal advantage to themselves, but only to the private sector, to the company producing the GM foods, much more skeptical.
It sounds to me like at the heart of all these issues we've talked about is better public education, maybe even in the universities, about science and its implication, especially for that part of the university community that does not become scientists, basically. So I it sounds like as an educator, one might have to think about that so that we don't have to depend on a sophisticated and subtle prime minister to make these changes, that it becomes part of the general dialogue.
Our analysis only goes part of that way. We have shown in various interactions with public groups that actually sometimes when people are better informed about the science, they become more skeptical. So it doesn't always play through in that way. In fact, the way we're beginning to tackle this now, and I'm not saying we have all the answers, of course, is to engage with the public in debates on open issues of the future, the direction science is going in. So we're trying to scan the horizon for the next GM or the next cloning debate in advance so that the scientific community can work knowing what concerns the public have in advance and try and take that into account. So setting up communication between the public on the one hand and the scientist on the other. Now, the scientist will say, but I'm in a better position to talk about the safety of what I'm producing. But the public is the consumer, and we have to respect that. And what is the public looking for in terms of the risks they're prepared to take? With cell phones, we discover that when the government put out a warning message that there may be problems associated with long-term usage of cell phones, particularly, we said, by children under the age of 12, actually the public didn't worry too much about it. And the reason is, it turns out the public are much more interested in the added convenience to themselves from the cell phones. On the other hand, the masts that produce that convenience, every time planning permission is to place a mast near somebody's house, they object. Because there's no personal advantage to them in having it just there. Now, the public as consumer is an important part of this whole debate, and we're trying to engage with that process.
One final question. If students were to watch this interview, how would you advise them to prepare for the future, their future, our future, both as a scientist and as somebody who's watched government work as it uses science?
Well, I mean, let me interpret your question in this way. My view is that as we move through this century, the biggest challenge to science is no longer really how do we generate a wealthier population through technological development? How do we develop a healthier population? We've done extremely well on those, and we'll continue to develop them. I think the real problem is we're going to reach a population by 2050 on this planet of 9 billion people. And the reason we're going to do that is because science has created all this capability for us to live long, happy, healthy lives, and therefore to raise the population level. The new challenge for science, and it's a terrific one, is how do we manage to live on this planet with improved wealth creation for everyone, but at the same time with very limited resources. In other words, I do think this century the big challenge for young people is bringing the best science and technology into the sustainability debate. We have to tackle questions around producing drugs, for example, with much less wastage of solvents. We have to produce the high-tech advantages that society wants with much less wastage of energy in the production process. These are the real challenges we're faced with. So I think addressing that problem with young people will also, by the way, address society's needs, and so we begin to come back into trust of the public.
With that note on hope, Sir David, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.